Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk Radio.
Tonight's topic. Well, first of all, I'd like to say I have just received my brand new microphone in the mail, so I hope that today's reception is much, much better. All right, so we're going to turn the volume up a bit, and hopefully that's going to take care of it. All right, here we go. So today's topic is waking up is hard to do. And this topic was prompted by a client asking me, well, what do you do? How do you handle it when you're awake and everyone around you is still asleep? You know, how do you live? How do you just exist? And so I figured best way to communicate that would be to share my experiences of times when I woke up. Sometimes I went back to sleep. Sometimes I stayed awake, and just kind of going through and reviewing those things. Now, the situation people find themselves in, once they become aware of the threats to their health, you know, how do you relate to the sleepwalkers around you? How do you react to the dangers that you become aware of, but other people accept as harmless everyday events? Is it better to just go back to sleep? So, as I said, I'm going to share my experiences of waking up, moments of doubt, months of sleeplessness, and finally, how I discovered increased happiness. So, as always, think happens. So, what we're going to do is, of course, go back to the original lyrics from the song, Waking Up is Hard to Do. Now, we have to be clear about this. This is a song by Neil Sedaka, and I believe its original song is Breaking Up is Hard to Do. But waking up is actually the same as breaking up, because when you wake up, you're essentially breaking up with old views and perspectives that you find were simply not true. So breaking up and waking up are actually very similar. So here's the lyrics. This is the waking up lyrics. Waking up is hard to do. You slept all night. Now it's morning time. Don't you cry. Don't be blue. Waking up is hard to do. Now notice he says that you slept all night. In other words, you can't wake up unless you were first asleep. And so he's telling this person, don't you cry, don't be blue, waking up is hard to do, instead of going back to bed, don't go back to sleep. You got to stretch and face the day. Rise and shine. Your dreaming is through. Waking up is hard to do. And so it's exactly the same when it comes to your health. When it comes to becoming aware of how you believe things that were not correct. One big thing to get over, of course, is just the embarrassment and the humiliation. It's important, I think, to just totally dispense with that and say, you know what, I'm not even going to go there. I believe what I believed. Now I believe something different, and that's it. I'm moving forward. Now, in my particular life, one big turning point happened at the age of 5. And that's when I turned on somebody turned on the TV, the news. Actually, I never developed the authority to turn on the TV or off the TV or change channels until I was pretty old, actually, in my late teens. So the TV was already on. And the news lady said, this is news channel, blah, blah, blah. This is news you can use. And that really stuck with me. And not that the news was useful or anything, but when I got news, I had an obligation to put it to use. Say, okay, I've got this information. What can I do with it? How can I adjust my actions or my beliefs in a more positive way based on this new information? So I had, from the age of 5, probably a little earlier, the perspective that any information I received, I had an obligation to put it to use. So I kind of started out with the assumption that at the age of 5 or so, that there's a lot of stuff I didn't know, and a lot of stuff maybe I thought I knew, and I was always looking for new information to try and update my data files with more accurate stuff. And so I always had the perspective that it's okay to wake up, or really to be awake. And I was always very excited and looked forward to growing up and trying to get things right, or to focus on what was really going on, whatever that might be. So as always, we got to get definitions. We got to know what we're talking about here. So what does it mean to wake up? Well, according to Webster's Online Dictionary, it's awaking or being awakened, to wake after sleeping. Okay, it means you were asleep. And that to me was like seriously vague, and I could not get any clarification on that. So I said, let me take a look at the opposite of awake. And that would be, of course, asleep. And if you look deeply for asleep, you're going to find unconscious. Unconscious is in a condition similar to sleep in which you do not see, feel, or think. Very good. A similar condition, similar to sleep, where you do not see, feel, or think. And a synonym to asleep is oblivious. And now we've got, this is where the meat of the matter is. To be out of touch with something, not know the first thing, not have the first idea about something, have no concept of something, lose touch with something, not have a clue, be no judge of something, not be any the wiser, and be unconscious of something. Okay, so oblivious, again, relates to unconscious. And then the other thing is, another synonym for it is ignorant, unacquainted, unknowing, unsuspecting, which is important, unsuspecting. Unfamiliar, uninformed, lost, hazy, illiterate, ill-informed. And then, of course, we have the word then is ignorant. That means not knowing something that you should know or that you need to know. So unsuspecting is important, and not knowing something that you need to know. Also, unacquainted, which means no knowledge of something. Not knowing what kind of situation you are involved in, for example, because someone has tricked or cheated you. And this is really pertinent to medicine, because doctors are seriously uninformed, seriously tricked, seriously cheated They enter medical school unsuspecting, and this state is transferred also to the patient, not only by the doctor, but by the media, by public education, and by many different avenues. Not knowing about something that's happening or will happen, unfamiliar, if you're unfamiliar with something, you have no knowledge of experience of it, uninformed, without knowledge or information about something, and lost, unable to understand something because it is extremely complicated. And hazy, if you're in a haze about a particular subject, you don't know or understand much about it. And illiterate, lacking knowledge in a particular subject, and ill-informed, showing a lack of knowledge on a particular subject. So I'm going to share with you times in my life where I've been oblivious to, asleep, and the painful process of awakening. Now, some of these cases, I didn't wake at all. I just slept right through it. And I'll give you the example where I just slept right through it. The first incident in terms of health where I was just totally oblivious was when I was in college, my freshman year, and I'd gotten rather sick. I got so sick that I couldn't get out of bed. It was a respiratory illness. I was coughing and I was sputtering, and I was pretty confident that I would live through it, but I was coughing and sputtering and couldn't get out of bed because I was just so weak. And so, of course, friends of mine came to my bedside, and everyone offered all kinds of interesting information, and I thought it was very nice of them to even show up. I felt really honored that my fellow Harvard classmates would come to my bedside. And, of course, I had only one request. Buy me 2 cups of yogurt, blueberry-flavored, please. And I even had the money. Whipped out then a dollar bill, bought 2 cups of yogurt. And so the person I handed the money, she said, well, you know, dairy causes mucus. And this is not going to be helpful, I don't think, for your condition. I look at the person. Well, you know, be a good friend and go get me the yogurt. Totally oblivious. And went right by me. I did not even absorb that piece of information. And and so I started to hold the aspartame. Absolutely. I only took mine with the real stuff, the sugar. So that went right by me. The second opportunity to wake up occurred again in college. This time, my grades are great, everything's going really good. I was applying to medical school. It was, I think I'd gotten my first acceptance letter. No, it was before my, before that. I took my medical entrance exams and did very well on them. So it's obvious I was going to medical school. So I decided that it was time for me to get my plan together, because I wanted to go back to the ghetto where I grew up and start medical practice and help people have a better quality of life, live longer, and have better lives. That was my goal. Of course, accomplishing this through providing health care and being a doctor. So I went to the library and searched, and could not find a single reference that indicated medical care was of benefit to anybody, let alone the population. And I actually got 2 books out that were very clear, and they said that healthcare absolutely does not improve the overall longevity and health of any population. Well, that could be a real wake-up, and that really stopped me in my tracks, temporarily, of course. And so by that point, I was pretty well into things. I was 3 years into Harvard, and I said, well, okay, let me take a look at this. Maybe when I go to medical school, I'll learn something useful. I said, but if this really isn't going to be as useful as I think it's going to be for my patients, then I'm not going to borrow money to go to medical school. And so what I did is I went right back to sleep and made a mitigating decision. So I was like, okay, maybe this is the case, maybe it's not the case, but just in case it's true, I won't borrow any money to go to medical school. All right. Then I arrived in medical school. Medical school, I saw, what could only be described as torture. And this is patients, grown people, yelling and screaming as needles were plunged into their body. And that for me was a wake up, like, whoa, wait a minute, whoa, this is not right. Now, what I did not take into account was the special lecture we medical students were given, indicating that we were not like regular people. We could do things that other people would be arrested if they did. So we had special powers and special privileges. But I said, no, I'm not buying that. People are people. This is torture. And so I told myself, I did not have to do that when I became a doctor. Again, right back to sleep. And obviously, if I had waken up, I would have said, man, I'm out of here. I'm not going to stay in this house of torture and horrors. So I told myself I didn't have to do that when I became a doctor. And actually, I didn't. And medical school, also, again, I saw that the therapies were not providing relief. People were not getting relief. They were coming back again and again and again. And so, of course, medical school instructors had a nice excuse for me. One, the patients were non-compliant. And two, even if they were compliant, they might be receiving the 50% of care that's not effective because this basic information is not accurate. And of course, there's always more research. And if I drop out of medical school now, I won't be there when that superior research is available. I won't be able to give the improved and better relief. And so I said, okay, all right, I'm going to get through this. And the other thing that really should have woken me up, but didn't, was I graduated from medical school. I finished my first year of residency, and I decided, aha, now I will serve my obligations to government. So government paid for 3 years of my medical school, and I had an obligation to pay them 3 years of working in a remote area of the United States where you could not even pay people to work. So I decide I'm going to do the right thing. I promised I would do this, and I'm going to fulfill my obligation. And so I get a letter from the government saying, you are in default of your obligation because we don't have your address. Now, mind you, they mailed it to my correct address. It was not forwarded. It went straight to my correct address, and I opened it. You are in default. Please pay immediately $250,000. Now, straight out, this is simply an extortion play, just an attempt to extort money from me is all. They said they would pay for my education, which they paid $40,000, and in exchange for that, I would agree to work in underserved area. And that was the agreement. And so they decided that they would default on their part by declaring me in default and saying, no, we're not going to let you serve your obligation. We're not even going to give you a list of places where you can serve. We just want $250,000 from you. Again, I was totally oblivious, and I said to myself, it's a mistake. Government's good. Government's my friend. Must be an accident. So, of course, I had to prevail upon my U.S. Senator, then our inspector of Pennsylvania, and his office intervened on my behalf. The whole thing was straightened out, and I got a list, and I went off to serve my obligation. And so, of course, I just let that go by. Again, just oblivious. So then, as luck would have it, I became pregnant, which I was very happy to be pregnant. And actually, as with most pregnant ladies, I just abruptly became ill, about, 2 months into the pregnancy. And I knew from my experience in medical school that at 2 months of the pregnancy, the baby cannot be saved. That's number one. But number two, I also knew that with my symptoms, I could not be saved. So it occurred to me that death was imminent. And I decided I've always wanted to be a vegetarian. And in medical school, they told me it was a deadly diet. So I figured this was the perfect time to become vegetarian. So I did. And lo and behold, 24 hours later, I felt perfectly fine. And had a wonderful vegetarian pregnancy. Now, this for me was a real head scratcher. Like, wait a minute, they must have lied to me in medical school, and they said that being vegetarian is deadly. I said, why would they do that? Then, of course, again, go back to sleep. You have the 50% that's inaccurate. Maybe they're still doing research on vegetarian diets. And so the reason I give you all these examples is to say that even the best of us may take several attempts to wake up. And so the way that pregnancy went was I totally didn't do anything the doctor recommended, nothing. And it was a wonderful pregnancy, easy, no problem, uncomplicated delivery. So then I went on to Syracuse, New York, returned to Syracuse, purchased a city block, built a medical office building against all advice. Everyone said, don't do it. That's a bad neighborhood. You'll never make any money. But anyway, started medical practice, did very well. So here I was, this vegetarian person, really feeling just awesome. And so I also noticed that white flour seemed to be a universal problem, that there did not seem to be any health benefit of eating bread. So what I did then was I developed recipes where I would use ground flaxseed as a thickener instead of white flour. And then I realized that cheese was a problem for a lot of people, so I mixed nutritional yeast and salt as a cheese substitute. And then as an egg substitute, the flaxseed thickener, only using it with less water than with the white flour. And then I found that eating organic really helped people a lot. And then I noticed that people were getting better from incurable diseases like arthritis, hypertension, diabetes. I said, wait a minute, wait. Then I really woke up. That was a terrible, terrible, terrible weekend. Oh my God. Could it be that everything I was taught in medical school was designed not so much to keep people sick, but to make them sick and make them sicker? This was a real problem. This was a problem. The other thing that happened, as I was making up these recipes to help people stick to a healthy lifestyle, is I noticed my first year of medical practice, there were about 4 deaths. And everyone who died was taking medications exactly according to the proper dose. They were perfectly diagnosed, fully diagnosed. They'd been to see the specialist, and everything was done absolutely properly according to medical school standards and the standards of care. And so when I started developing these recipes and writing recipes on prescription pads and giving people choices, the death rate went to zero, zilch, nothing. And I said, aha, So this really got me. I was asleep. I don't think I slept for at least 3 months. I was tossing and I was turning. What am I going to do? People have insurance. They want the best medical care. The best care might not be medical. I don't want to kill anybody. What should I do? And so at this point, I was wide awake. So I decided, well, you know, people are adults. They can decide. And so I was going to give them a choice of what they want to do. Whether they want drugs or diet, whatever they want to do. And I found that the death rate went to zero. Then I noticed that patients who did not have bowel movements, 3 a day to be precise, they couldn't heal. And so I realized people needed to poop 3 times a day. I was absolutely shocked that people who are miraculously cured just by pooping 3 times a day. Now, in medical school, I was clearly instructed that a bowel movement once a week is quite okay. Anything more often than that, the person is regular, and whatever their disease, the bowels are not an issue. And so I realized that was false, and that practice, the practice of pooping once a week, would create illness in just about anybody. Then I started taking a look at the protocols. And the protocols, doesn't matter if the protocol is, we're already the same. Start with one drug, if it doesn't work, add another drug, if it doesn't work, add another drug. And I noticed that there are some protocols that routinely the first three drugs just simply didn't work. And so I said, well, why don't I just skip to drug 4 or 5 in the protocol and spare the patient the expense and side effects of drugs 1 through 3. Lo and behold, people would finally get results with drug 3 or 4 along the protocol, and it was a lot easier, and people got results a lot quicker. Then, of course, I started developing herbal substitutes for the different drugs. And so I realized that something was wrong. And then I had another pregnancy, second pregnancy. Actually, it's a little bit out of order. I had my second pregnancy before I opened my practice. But this pregnancy was devastating. I did everything right. I gained my usual 56 pounds. I worked as, you know, the workaholic, pregnant, took vitamins. By this time, I was an obedient patient. I went to every single prenatal visit except one. And even that one, I, you know, called the doctor and said, hey, you know, I'm a little tired. So I had an unnecessary C-section, of which I had complications. Then I had a second surgery, which of course was unnecessary because the first one was unnecessary, but there was a complication with the abdominal bypass. And then, of course, my doctor started calling me by my skin color instead of my name. At that point, I was so sick, and it was clear to me that my chances of leaving the hospital alive were just not great. And I could have just deduced that the doctor was racist, and he was trying to kill black people, but my mind wasn't that complicated. All I knew was I was in serious danger and losing ground. And so I fired my doctor and hired a new doctor. And so the new doctor, did the second surgery to clear up the abscess the first doctor created, and I didn't leave the hospital. 6 months later, when I finally recovered enough to walk and write my name, I went back to work. Now, I also moonlighted a second job at the county women's clinic. And there, I met two patients who had had a C-section by this very same doctor and had the same complications that I had. So I said, aha, a pattern, three. Three makes a pattern, just for you who don't know the definition of a pattern. And so it was clear, and these ladies are very thankful. They're very thankful they had such an astute doctor who detected their abdominal abscess, did the necessary surgery to fix it, and that they are alive today and they have healthy children. And so what I realized then was the chat room is trying to guess what name the doctor called me. He called me my skin color. He called me Brown. He said, how is the brown one doing this morning? And that's when I realized that I had zero chance of getting out of the hospital alive under his care. And so while I met these two other women, both of whom were white, who had had the exact same experience with the same doctor, only he had apparently called them by their proper name, and they had a different story in their minds surrounding the occurrence. And it was then that I realized that people, regardless of their race and regardless of their income level, are at risk of being murdered by their doctor. Now, one might be murdered in a circumstance where maybe you have fluffier cushions, maybe the doctor addresses you in a more courteous manner, but the protocols are no less, they're no less deadly. And the outcome is pretty much the same. And this was a huge, huge wake-up call for me, and I did not go back to sleep on this one. Of course, I had already gone to the lawyer to see if I could sue, because this was obviously a bad thing that this doctor had done. The lawyer refused to accept the case. Now, the next thing I realized once I met these other two women was that I knew I had insurance. So this doctor had gotten paid very handsomely. So he dragged out what would have been an overnight situation, just go to the hospital, have the baby, go home, into a 16-day affair. So the hospital, his partner, every doctor consulted on my case all had to know about this doctor's record. This was huge for me. And I definitely did not go back to sleep on it. So I realized that the hospital profited handsomely, in this case, to the tune of $11,000, instead of $600. So each time this doctor pulled this, the hospital had huge profits on it. So what did I do? At that point, I became a staunch home birth advocate. Had my third baby at home. And advocate home birth to anybody who would listen. And that was not very many people. Now, I had my third child at home, unattended, for the whopping cost of $250. Yes, that's the bed sheets, the receiving blankets, all the little nicks, everything you could think of buying for a home birth. I even had a little oxygen tank with a little baby mask in case, you know, I needed that. So, I had no complications of this home VBAC. And this $250 was less than my deductible would have been on my insurance policy had it gone to the hospital. So this for me was such a huge wake-up call. I dropped my insurance. I just dropped it. And I started offering home birth as an option in my medical practice. And I advised my friends and employees to drop their health insurance and keep the money. I even offered to my employees, look, I'll just give you the cash that I would spend every month for your health insurance. Back then it was $350, which is a lot of money back in the early 90s. But still, the bigger picture eluded me. So another wake-up call was an uneasy feeling. The call from my, not mine, but an insurance agent. There are people out there who sell health insurance for a living. And what they do is they go to a business and they say to the human resources department, look, I'd like to help you buy insurances for your employees. I have any of these 20 plans. We can set up a situation where your employees can pick from any of these plans and blah, 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 whatever. And then the company agrees to buy these things through him, saves them a heck of a lot of paperwork. He gets a commission and he feeds his family. There are people like that out there. Not to say they're good or bad, but just that they exist. So there's a guy who, this is the way he made his living. And he's married, had a couple kids. And by that time, I think I had two kids. I might have had my third kid by then, but I had two kids. But we were in a similar situation in life, you know, just trying to raise our family. So he called me up and he says, Dr. Daniels, you know, I really hate to make this phone call, but, you know, I don't know what else to do. I'm an insurance broker, it's a health insurance, and, you know, just trying to feed my family here, and everybody I call on won't buy any of the insurance that I have. And so I, you know, can't make a living. I said, well, that's unfortunate. He said, well, yeah, and the reason they won't buy any insurance is because you are not a physician on any of the plans that I carry. And this is a real problem. I said, well, yeah, I'd like to help you out. What insurances do you carry? And he listed the different HMOs and other insurances that never paid a doctor. I said, oh, you know, I can't sign up with any of those. And I told him, because, you know, if I sign up, then I gotta sign this clause that says they can demand that I provide health care to their subscribers for a full year and not pay for a full year, as long as the subscribers have paid them the insurance premium. And he's like, whoa, that's no good. That doesn't make any sense. Well, you can't take care of your family. I said, exactly. So that's why I can't take the insurances. He said, wow, I can see why you can't help me. It's okay, yeah, I gotta figure something out. So, okay. So I didn't think anything of the phone call. I thought that we had communicated well, we understood each other, and he was going to just find another way to feed his family, and I was going to continue to feed my family. Good news. Then I got a phone call. Well, first of all, I had my baby, the third baby, at home. Of course, I had the baby at home to save my life. And so I'm still asleep, took the baby to the hospital to get the heel stick to check for those diseases that none of the kids have, you know, thyroid and all the other kinds of stuff, which now turns out was just a government ploy to get genetic DNA material on every human being that was born. But anyway, I was asleep. I missed that one. So I took the baby into the hospital. And the hospital vice president for finance says to me, well, you could have at least come to the hospital and just dropped the baby, and we would have got paid. And so here was the chief financial officer of the hospital asking me to assist him in defrauding the insurance company. Because obviously the health care was unnecessary, because I just stayed at home and had the baby with no problem. And so, and this is like a super nice guy, and we've been friends, and he's helped me get my practice going, and all kinds of stuff. And so I was a little disturbed by this statement, but I just let it go by, stayed asleep, and didn't even have it. Then, a few months later, I got a call from a clerk at the hospital, or actually not a clerk, but a person in the executive offices of the hospital. And as a doctor, when you get a call from someone in the executive offices of the hospital, that is a call you absolutely must take and treat carefully. So I accepted this call, and the lady on the other end said, hi, Dr. Daniels. This is Sosa calling from the community hospital. And I said, oh, hi, Sosa. How are you? It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And she said, you know, we've noticed that we're not seeing many of your patients for your x-ray tests here at the hospital. And we're prepared to make it easier for you to refer to the hospital, whatever we have to do. I said, oh, Susie, that's not a problem. You know, you're my favorite hospital. I send all of my people to your hospital for all of their tests. And so I'm not sending them anyplace else. All of my patients are going to your hospital for their tests. And she said, oh. And my heart sank because I knew that I had said the wrong thing. And she hung up the phone. And so that I realized then, like, wait a minute, something's going on here. I'm supposed to be creating excuses for people to get laboratory tests. I'm supposed to be having people get laboratory tests that are totally unnecessary. I'm not supposed to be giving them a choice or saying to them, you know, the standard of care says to do this laboratory test, but quite frankly, I've been doing it for 5 years now, and it's not had one positive test so far, so if you want to do the test, that's fine, but if you don't want to, I can understand. So that was not the speech I was supposed to be giving my patients, but that was the speech I was giving. So then, of course, the last ominous phone call that I got. At that point, I was waking up. I was troubled. I was worried. I knew something was wrong. I couldn't put my finger on it, but I knew something was wrong. Then came the phone call from the vice president of the largest HMO in town. And he said, Dr. Daniels, I see you have not signed a farm contract. I said, that's true. He said, I'm going to send a courier to your office with the contract, and I want you to sign it. I said, well, that's not possible. And I told him about that fancy clause, which of course is in his contract. And he said, Dr. Daniels, I want you to sign the contract. I said, well, I won't be signing it. And he just hung up. Click, hung up the phone. So I realized then that something is wrong here. There is something I was not aware of. And of course, then the drug rep came to pay me a visit, my favorite drug rep, one who knew my children's birthdays, their hobbies, and brought them all kinds of age-appropriate, hobby-appropriate toys and gifts. Really, just incredible. And she came in a terrible pout, very upset. And I said, oh, my good buddy here, of course we can work this out. Well, we could not work out. Well, she took a serious cut in pay because I was not prescribing her drug anymore, and she was very, very upset about it. I said, well, you know, I've given you samples and a prescription, and I guess I'm not filling it. He says, well, now you're filling my competitor's prescription. That's when I realized I had a problem that I could not handle here. And so I said, well, I think it's time for you to leave because I'm not going to engage in a conversation about your competitors. And she stormed out and really just very unsettled. You can imagine, I purchased the land, which I own, I built the building, which I own, and someone's going to trounce into my office and attempt to intimidate me and discipline me. I'm like, And, of course, what I didn't realize is, while doctors may have licenses, their true supervisors really are the drug companies and the hospitals and the insurance companies. So all three of my supervisors had expressed their displeasure with my performance in terms of aiding and abetting and adding to the bottom line. So this is a real problem. So I wasn't quite awake yet. Not awake yet. Until I got a letter. I got a letter from the licensing board, and the letter said, we want the chart of ABC person. I thought, what's going on here? Of course, I called the medical society, this is why I pay my dues, so I can have somebody to call and these things happen. So I called the medical society, and they said, well, Dr. Daniel, you've got to give them that chart. I said, well, wait a minute. Well, they didn't give me a signed consent form from the patient. Dr. Daniel, this is not that kind of case. You have to give them that chart. I said, well, okay. So it took 3 days, and I gave them the chart. And he said, and the medical society, there's some nurses. And you know, Dr. Daniel, it's probably all they'll want because we know you're a good doctor. I said, oh, okay. So it takes them, I think, a month or two, and they come back with, we found evidence of the inappropriate practice of medicine. Oh, no, they found a pattern of, pattern of inappropriate practice of medicine. So pattern, of course, means three cases. You can't find three cases with anything. It's one chart, because there's only one chart. There you go. And so I said, okay, I need a lawyer. And I realized at that point that the fix was in, and I needed the best lawyer. So I got a lawyer who was a Yale graduate and who was roommates with the assistant director of the licensing board in New York City. I said, this is what I need. And so one thing led to another. But the important thing to realize here was that I went from lawyer to lawyer to lawyer. Each lawyer, when they read the facts of my case, which is basically patient got better with therapy, no harm done, alive and well. Okay, that's the broad stroke summary. They said, easy beans, no problem. And after they talked to the licensing board, they were generally trembling, fearful, and told me to get lost and kept my deposit. And one lawyer even said to me, I will give you back your deposit if you promise to never, ever mention my name again. And so I realized I had an unusual case here. And, of course, again, I grew up in the 60s with the Civil Rights Movement. And so I thought laws were evenly enforced. And after all, the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s, the government had to follow the laws when it came to blacks. And in the past, when I was still, the government tried to harass me a little bit, like with that, trying to extort $250,000 from me. All it took was a few phone calls, you know, and took care of it. And so I thought this would be, hopefully, along the same line. Well, it wasn't. So the government broke many laws. Supposedly, you can't investigate any case where the patient gets better with therapy. That broke that law. Whenever you have a hearing, you have to allow the patient's chart as evidence. They refused to allow the patient's chart as evidence. That broke that law. And it went on and on. Oh, my final sentence, which was a lifetime suspension of my license. It only allowed a suspension for 3 years. And then, of course, at that time, you cannot state it, but they can only initially suspend it for 3 years. So they broke that law. So there's a whole list of laws, actually six that they broke. I'm like, oh, boy. So now I was getting wide awake, and couldn't go back to sleep. So I even looked at the government and said, you know, can't we work this out? Is there a plea bargain here somewhere? Or, no, you know, figure out what I did wrong, and maybe I could not do it wrong anymore. We just go back to sleep and just kind of smooth things over here. There was no going back to sleep. The government said, no, there will be no discussion. There will be no plea bargain. You are done. And so, I woke up. That's it. I woke up. And I could not go back to sleep. It's like being born and the baby's trying to crawl back into the womb. There just wasn't anything to go back to. You know, in the case of the baby, once the baby gets born, the placenta is spit out, the uterus contracts and shrinks up. There is no going back. And so that's what happened. Incredible, abrupt awakening with no going back. So then I was left to try and figure out what I had done wrong. And throughout the whole ordeal, which lasted, let's see, I don't say 6 years. Yeah, 6 years. Finally, I got a lawyer who was the lawyer for the politician. So he only defended the guilty. And he was really good. He said, look, Dr. Daniels, you probably killed a few patients. It's not a problem. We can fix it. I said, oh, my God. You think I killed somebody? Ah, don't worry. Every doctor does it. I said, oh, my God. Well, how do I find out who I killed? Because everybody, you know, everyone I knew in my practice was a lie. I didn't know anybody who got me. So he told me that every hospital keeps a secret file. This is the name of the file. This is the name of the secret department in every hospital you go to. And sure enough, he was right. I went to every single hospital. It's only three. And I went to the secret department. I asked the secret department. And they raised their eyebrows and called security. And told me where the secret department was. Of course, security was right outside the door. And then I asked for my secret file. And they went through a whole big rigmarole. But every place I went to, there was nothing in my secret file. It was clean as a whistle. So I said, I should have gone back to the lawyer if I didn't. I said, you know what? I'm not guilty. You can't possibly help me. So it was just the beginning of an incredible, abrupt wake-up call. You know, I had believed that my family liked me. Why? Just because I was Jennifer. And it took them about 5 years of me not having a license before the respect I was accustomed to evaporated. Then, you know, all of these things started happening in my life. And then I finally had to say, at least I have children. At least my children don't know how far I've fallen, so to speak. And then my mother decided she would educate my children and tell them how stupid I was to have lost the license. So it was really just absolutely, totally traumatic process. And people would say things to me like, you can go back to school and become a naturopathic doctor. You could do this, you could do that. The idea of going back to school for 4 years, I just scratched my head and made no sense. And then a license, if they can take a license away like that, they can take any kind of license. I don't need a license. And so at that point, then 9-11 happened. Actually, 9-11 happened earlier, but 9-11 happened in the midst of the whole process. And then I decided, okay, I know. I'll do what Dad said. I'll start my own business, do my own thing, be my own boss, and just strike out on my own. So that entailed, of course, meeting people, trying to figure out the lay of the land was and what kind of business I might want to start. So you get on planes for that, only to find I was on the terrorist watch list. So if you don't know, you get four big capital S's on your ticket, and they take you aside for special humiliation and mistreatment. And so I couldn't fly because I was on the terrorist watch list. And the thing is, they always, as they're harassing you, ask you, do you want to go in the back room? And this is worse than going to the principal's office when you're in school. Of course, I would always say, no, not the back room. I will strip nude right here in public for all to see, but not the back room. I never got to the back room. Then I was getting letters from the government saying, I'm going to do not employ them. And when I got on one list, I said, no problem, I can work around this. I got a second letter, after the second do not employ list, I'm like, I don't think I can work around this. So I was prohibited from employment any place in the government with any company that had a contract with a government and from any company that accepted funds or money from the government. And it was just overwhelming to even attempt to put together a resume and even float it to somebody or even share it. And so finally I realized as they were passing the Patriot Act and more things, that I was so uncomfortable being on a terrorist watch list, being unable to lie, unable to work, and seeing my net worth just plummet. I mean, just plummet on the rocks. And I decided I needed another country when I left the country. And it only took about a month for me to at least be able to sleep at night, which is really good. I was able to sleep at night. And little bit by little bit, I said, well, you know, I'm just going to do what I want to do, what I enjoy doing. And it did not pay very well at all, I want you to know. And so then I started the radio show. And once I started the radio show, well, actually what happened was I met a marketer, an internet marketer down here in Canada. And so we got to talking and figured out, he says, well, you know, you got anything that works? Any miraculous cure for anything? I said, yeah, sure. I got a bottle of turpentine. And I said, it works great. It cures pain, cures this, cures that, everything. And he happened to have a girlfriend who was in pain all the time. So I put some turpentine on one of the painful spots, and boom, a minute later, the pain was gone. And she said, oh, my God, all my pain is gone. And so, of course, he said, no, it can't be. It didn't work. He said, yes, 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 it's gone. And so then we got together, we did a bit of marketing, and the Candida Cleaner was born. So I did the writing, he did the marketing. And that kind of kicked the ball off. And then I started a radio show, and now I'm very happy living in a place that's warm, doing research, waking myself up every day, finding out more and more things. And these are things that I didn't have time to investigate when I was working as a doctor because I was just too busy working. So now that is my work, is investigating these things, uncovering these things, and bringing them to light. And so what's happened then, oh, I met somebody and got married. Can you believe that? So at the age of 51, I got married. So what I'm saying then is it's difficult for anyone to wake up. Waking up is difficult, period. And once you actually wake up, I would recommend waking up as often as possible. In other words, whenever you get information that you may realize, well, this is the problem over here, embrace it. Go ahead. Wake up. Excuse me. You'll be uncomfortable for a few minutes or months, maybe even a few years. But things will adjust. And when I became vegetarian, my family was very upset about it. But, hey, I compromised. I said, you know, guys, I'm not eating meat, but I'll make the roast for every single holiday. You know, I'll make the leg of lamb, I'll make the standing rib roast, I'll make the crown roast. No problem, as long as I don't have to eat it. And so people were very, very grateful. And so the moral of the story is, in order for you to wake up, you have to be very kind, nice, and courteous to those who are still asleep. So if you let people who are asleep continue to sleep, then they will let you wake up and even facilitate your awakening. So it's just a two-way street. And remember, you would love to sleep. And so how would you like to be treated? So we have a few minutes for questions. If you have a question and you're on phone, you can click number one. And if you're in the chat room and you have a question, we'll answer that. Oh, lots of questions in the chat room. Let me find. Okay, we have a question on the line. Uh-oh. Great. Hi, what's your question?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I'm calling because I actually wanted some advice. I'm a 29-year-old mother. I just had a baby. She's 4 months now. And I had complications through the entire pregnancy with preeclampsia. During the beginning of the pregnancy, they asked me to terminate the pregnancy, and I refused, and I continued, but was put on bed rest. After I had her, my body completely, like, crashed, and my blood pressure was in the 200s and stayed that way for about 4 days. They had me on magnesium, and they had me on several different types of blood pressure medication.
So what's going on right now, what's going on?
Well, basically, right now, my blood pressure has spikes. Recently, when I checked it about a few weeks ago, it was 200 over, I think, 130. I do have some symptoms as my vision once in a while. It gets a little off, blurry, and I do have ringing in the ear periodically.
We have four minutes left. So, basically, what you need to understand is your hypertension right now is just like anybody else's hypertension. And so your solution, is, from a natural perspective, would be there's a lot of work you got to do with your diet. If your baby's 4 months old, you might still be breastfeeding. And so maybe some herbs that would help your blood pressure that might not be compatible with breastfeeding. So the best way to really kind of drill down and sort through this would be to go to the website, which is drjenniferdaniels.com, and to click on the discovery session link to kind of go deeper. But there's a lot going on here. There's something going on during your pregnancy in terms of dietary slash lifestyle things. Whatever it is still going on now. And so it would take an extensive review of quite a few things, in other words, more than 3 minutes, in order to get to the bottom of it. So that would be the best way to get at what's going on. And also, ultimately, it sounds like what you're looking for is a solution that's compatible with motherhood. So that requires personalized tailoring, which really can't be done, ad hoc or just kind of off the cuff. So that would be the best thing for you to do. All right, we're going to go and we're going to check out the chat room. There's a lot of questions in the chat room. Okay, vegetarian with or without salt and added sesame oil. Okay, so vegetarian should be definitely salt to taste, very few added fats. Does one's body reset during a water fast? Answer is yes if you do it properly. Okay, coworker getting strong-armed by her doctor's office because she missed a well child visit. Okay, she needs to switch doctors and keep switching doctors, and that way she can perpetually put off this well-child visits. Purpose of well-child visits is to make your child sick. Okay. I think Dr. Dennis is the only doctor I like. All right. I can't get asthma medication. Seeing a doctor every 6 months. I don't understand that. I wonder if the clinic will try to build some kind of case where the child is not being properly cared for. Absolutely, they will. I had a patient like that. I had to go to court to get the child, help the parents get the child out of Child Protective. It's a real nightmare. You really want to hurry up and change doctors frequently and often, and eventually get your kid off the radar. All right, that's it for questions. End of today's episode. We will see you next week at Healing with Dr. Daniels, and we got a great show planned for next week. Let me see if I can find it. Next week is the City Mouse and the Country Mouse, and why you should not settle for less. All right, so we'll see you next week, and I have this little button here that I'm going to push. Here we are. Okay.